Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Sai Ram. This is the sixth talk in the special series of musings by Professor Venkatraman entitled The Essence of the Gita. This musing series on the Gita, presented by Radio Sai, comes to you in response to the many requests made by our listeners over the years. It is being broadcast in alternation with our other series on spiritual awareness. The two series are complementary to each other, and that is why we have intertwined them. We hope you enjoy both and find them to be beneficial. Over now to Professor Venkatraman.
At the outset, I offer my humble pranams to Swami and express my gratitude to Him for guiding me thus far. I seek His grace and blessings to navigate through the difficult topic I intend to cover today. Dear listeners, loving Sai Ram to all of you and greetings from Prashanthi Nilayam. We all think of Prashanthi Nilayam as an ashram in a village called Puttaparthi. In a purely geographical sense, that is perhaps true. But what Swami wants is our heart and mind to be the abode of peace or shanti, so that the whole world transforms into one huge, massive Prashanthi Nilayam. It is to help us transform the world in that manner that He has come down on earth, donning the human form. And it is in this context that He is teaching us all the time about Mama Dharma, which He taught earlier as Lord Sri Krishna. So we resume our explorations of the Mama Dharma aspect of the Gita, taking a brief look into chapter 6 this time. Before I start on that, let me remind you briefly of the ground we have covered thus far. I began by drawing your attention to the fact that adhering to Mama Dharma is the essential message or the core message of the Gita. I then led on to the second and subsequent chapters of the Gita, the early ones that is, and while dealing with them, I pointed out the following facts. A. Life is a series of actions. B. Actions must always be performed with an eye on Mama Dharma. C. In this matter of performing actions, we need the advice of the heart, which is conveyed to us via a pipeline called Buddhi. D. The pipeline called Buddhi can easily become clogged if the mind is allowed to be full of undesirable thoughts. So, to keep Buddhi in shape, sense and mind control are essential. E. One does not have to withdraw into the forest and become a recluse in order to do all this. In fact, Krishna wants us to be very much in the situation we are placed in by destiny and function within the bounds of Mama Dharma in that situation. While explaining all this, I also drew attention to the importance of mind and sense control. I hope that brief summary recalls for you at least some of the things I have said in my earlier talks thus far. In any case, at some point in the future, we hope to have all this placed on record in H2H for your convenience. Let me now turn to chapter 6, which is entitled Jnana Yoga, meaning the path to God via meditation. There are three questions that arise in this context. They are, 1. What exactly is meant by meditation? 2. Why meditation? And 3. What characterizes a person who meditates intensely? These questions are important and need some examination. The phrase Dhyana Yoga contains two words, Yoga and Dhyana. Yoga is often confused with physical exercises called yogasanas, while Dhyana is sometimes reduced to an exercise in stress relaxation. Yes, the formal discipline of Dhyana Yoga does call for the practice of yogasanas and mental relaxation. But these are only starters. The real objective of Dhyana Yoga is different. It is because not enough attention is given to the real objective that some have been able to skillfully market meditation and yoga as a business proposition. In fact, these days meditation has almost become an industry and a fashion, especially where the corporate sector is concerned. As I have been constantly stressing, the Gita is all about adhering to Mama Dharma, and for that, sense and mind control are a vital prerequisite. Chapter 6, which is the theme of this talk, is in a sense all about mind and sense control. Many questions arise, such as, what is this mind we are talking about? What is the relationship of this mind to the senses? Why on earth should we exert to achieve this control? Suppose we do control the mind and the senses, then what? Are there any fallouts? Are there any benefits? I would now like to deal briefly with these questions before I get into chapter 6. Let me start with the mind. This is a word we frequently use. In an intuitive way, we all understand, or rather think we understand, what the word mind means. But do we really? I don't think so. And so it's better we pause for a second to try and understand what we mean by this word. To appreciate the full meaning, it is useful to consider an analogy. Let us consider the sea and start, say, with the bottom. What we have there is lots and lots of salt water, with of course fish swimming around all over the place. Let's now go up until we come to the surface of the ocean. There we would see waves rising and crashing. Some waves would be big, while others would be small. The water in the waves is also salty, just as the water at the bottom is salty, though the waves have a different form as compared to the waters below, where there are no waves. If we go a little above the waves, we have foam, and above that salt spray. Some distance above the foam, the water exists in the air as small droplets and water vapor. The droplets are salty, while the water vapor, having come through evaporation, is pure water, no salt. If we keep ascending into the atmosphere and go way up, we would not find any droplets, naturally. However, there would be water vapor for sure, having originated through evaporation. This vapor is in a gaseous state as opposed to the water, which exists in the liquid state in the sea. The water vapor, once again, is pure H2O, no salt. What this example teaches us is that there is a continuum of water, with water existing as vapor and in a pure form way above the surface of the sea, as opposed to the water existing as liquid water with a lot of salt in it, way down below the surface of the sea. I have made a particular reference to this example because what we call the mind is a continuum of a similar nature. Unless we understand that extensive nature of the mind, we really cannot grasp what mind and sense control are all about. Maybe all this is a bit puzzling, to say the least. So let me explain, once again, trying a different set of words. You see, as I just said, the human mind is a vast continuum. At one end, whatever the mind does is just brain function. At this end, the mind is strongly integrated with the body. Way at the other end, the mind is far removed from the body because it is in a position to be immersed in the Atma. The middle mind is looking here and there. As Swami says, it's like a crow which has the habit of looking in one direction for a short while and then looking in the other direction a little later. The crow keeps on flitting all the while. The middle mind is all the time looking into the world and following all sorts of ephemeral and temporary attractions. It is in that sense, the middle mind is like a crow. This would not do if one is serious about Mama Dharma. If we want to make Mama Dharma the main objective of life, and that is what we really ought to do, at least that's what the Gita recommends, then we have to rise above the lower and the middle mind. That really is what mind and sense control is expected to achieve. With that background, I am now all set to introduce you to some of the key slokas in chapter 6. We have first a sloka that extols the virtue of renunciation. The Lord says, "Know that to be yoga, O Pandava, which is called renunciation, for none can become a yogi without renouncing the pursuit of desires." This is Sloka 6.2. What exactly is yoga? That the Lord clarifies as follows. When a man is not attached to the sense objects or to action, and in addition has shed all desires, then alone he is said to have ascended to yoga. This is Sloka 6.4. Now this is an important point. And the Lord adds the following, please follow it carefully. The Lord says, "Man should subjugate his mind to the self and not degrade himself by letting the mind become a slave of the lower self. The mind can thus be a friend or a foe." This is Sloka 6.5. And by the way, when I say man should subjugate his mind to the self, it means man should subjugate his mind to the higher self or the Atma. The Lord continues, "For him who has conquered the lower self by the higher self, that is, who has conquered the mind by the Atma, his mind is a friend. But for him whose mind is not responsive to the higher self, the mind becomes an enemy." This is Sloka 6.6. I am sure you have heard Swami say many times that the mind can be a foe as well as a friend. In fact, Swami gives a nice analogy. He says, the mind is like a key and the heart is like a lock. If the key is turned one way, the lock opens. If the key is turned the other way, the lock gets closed. That's the same thing that was told by Swami to Arjuna 5,000 years ago in a slightly different language. In this yoga, Swami uses the language of the lock and the key. What's the signature of a man who has renounced and turned his mind completely towards God? The Lord explains. The serene man, having subdued his mind and become absorbed in the higher self or Atma, is steadfast in the midst of pairs of opposites such as cold and heat, pleasure and pain, and also honor and ignominy. This is Sloka 6.7. That man is a true yogi who is content with wisdom and discrimination, who remains unshaken, who has conquered his senses, and to whom clay, stone and gold are alike. This is Sloka 6.8. He stands supreme who regards alike friends, enemies, neutrals, arbiters, the hateful, kinsfolk, as also saints and sinners. This is Sloka 6.9. So you see, it's important to develop equanimity. No doubt corporate managers are all the time asked to develop equanimity. But the Lord made clear 5,000 years ago that equanimity is even more important for one who is serious about following the spiritual path. One might argue that all this advice is fine as textbook material, but it's absolutely impractical. In fact, Arjuna himself raised such doubts. Yes, tough it is, but it's not impossible. That is what the Lord asserts in the following set of slokas. This state of severance from the misery of affliction and pain is known as yoga and should be practiced with determination and an undistracted mind. This is Sloka 6.23. And now for some golden rules concerning the discipline that must be adapted to achieve renunciation, detachment, equanimity, etc. Completely renouncing all desires arising from the thoughts of the world and fully curbing the mind by all senses, let him, the aspirant, little by little, reason controlled by fortitude, attain peace. And fixing his mind on the higher self, let him think of nothing else but peace. This form, slokas 24 and 25. The Lord continues, restraining the restless and fidgety mind from wandering, he should subjugate it solely to the higher self. This is Sloka 6.26. Okay, one does all this. What happens when one subjects oneself to such a tight discipline? The Lord reveals that also. He says, verily comes supreme bliss to that yogi whose mind is calm, whose passion is subdued, who is sinless, and who has become one with Brahman. This is Sloka 6.27. Thus, transcending sin, abiding always in the eternal, the yogi attains with ease the infinite bliss that flows from Brahman. This is Sloka 6.28. His mind harmonized by yoga, he sees himself in all beings, and all beings in himself, he sees the same in all. 6.29. He who sees me in everything and everything in me, him I shall never forsake, nor he shall lose me. This very important sloka is 6.30. He who established in oneness worships me as abiding in all beings, always lives in me, whatever he does. This is Sloka 6.31. And of all yogis, he who worships me with faith, with his mind concentrated upon me, him I consider to be the best. This is Sloka 6.47. Those are the followers of steadfastness and immersing the mind in God rather than in the ephemeral and transient world. You would notice this is another way of saying, O man, focus on the permanent rather than the transient. And O man, realize that this requires mind and sense control. I hope what I have said thus far would make you appreciate that following the spiritual path is not a matter to be treated casually. I have to stress this because these days people tend to live at such a fast pace that they are totally oblivious to the need for keeping some time for themselves for deep introspection and meditation. I do not want you to think that all I have said about the mind and the traps it lays are my own speculations. In fact, Swami himself has spoken about the mind on several occasions. And just to prove that to you, let me quote some of his observations. Commenting on how little we know about the mind, Swami says, and I quote, "Laymen glibly talk about the mind, without knowing what exactly the form and shape of the mind is. Words like mind, happiness and bliss are abstractions which do not have existence in space and time. Nevertheless, they do subsist in a special sense. Though they do not exist in form, none can deny the fact that they are real individual experiences. The mind is not an organ or a part of the body. It transcends the body. It is associated with universal consciousness. Men are accustomed to treat the mind as a part of the body. This relates only to the sensory activities of the mind. The mind is actually made up of thoughts and doubts. But the mind associated with divine Atma transcends the body. Consequently, it is only when the ordinary thought processes are extinguished that divinity within can be experienced. The consciousness that goes beyond thought is a reflection of the Atma. This is a very important quote, and I hope you will pay attention to it. Drawing attention to the power of the mind, Swami says, quote, "Man is not aware of the potentialities of the mind. The mind is the cause of all our sorrows and our joys. The powers of the mind are indescribable. In a moment, it can encompass the entire universe. In another moment, it can be a total blank. It can blossom in one moment and wither in the next. The mind is the cause of both good and bad." End of quote. Elsewhere, Swami says, quote, "Mind is a sharp sword. Man will be able to fulfill himself if he realizes the subtle and mysterious workings of the mind. Mind travels fast, is strong, lighter than ether, and subtler than electricity. Man becomes an easy prey to sorrow and suffering with directing the mind on questionable paths." End of quote. You may remember, I raised three questions in the beginning. Let me briefly return to them. Just to recall, the questions I posed were the following. 1. What exactly is meant by meditation? 2. Why meditation? And 3. What characterizes a person who meditates intensely? Based on the slokas that I have just quoted, one can give the following brief answers to the above questions. What exactly is meant by meditation? Well, meditation means placing one's mind entirely in God. Why meditation? Well, meditation is required because without placing our mind in God, we would go astray in our actions. And what characterizes a person who meditates intensely? A man who meditates intensely is ever calm and unruffled. He is characterized by equanimity. To wrap it all up, yes, Mama Dharma is what the Gita boils down to. However, in practice, adhering to Mama Dharma means we must subject ourselves to a certain discipline, and that discipline, among other things, calls for the regulation of the mind and sense control. You might ask, why on earth must we follow Mama Dharma? Well, that question would receive attention soon. In brief, basically it has got to do with the fact that each one of us is a part of the cosmos, which is manifest divinity. If divinity is in every atom of the cosmos, it follows it is immanent in each one of us also. And if divinity is immanent in each one of us, it had better show up in the way we live our lives. Surely we cannot afford to be divine at the core and allow our mind and senses to make us live like animals or devils, can we? And yet, is that not often the way people live today? How else did the much talked about global warming problem crop up suddenly? Is it not due to the extensive air pollution caused by man? Thus polluting the air God has given us so that we may live, constitute being in harmony with nature? Is it not our duty to be in harmony with nature? Is it not our duty to follow Mama Dharma? Think about it. Jai Sai Ram, and I hope to meet you again next week. Till then, may God be with you.
You have been listening to a talk by Professor Venkatraman in the Musing series on the essence of the Gita. The next talk in this series would be broadcast the week after next at the same time. We hope you enjoyed this program. Please do write to us with your comments. You may reach us at listener@radiosci.org. This program came to you from the studios of Radio Sci, which broadcasts 24 hours a day the loving message of Bhagavan Sri Satya Sai Baba.